Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции! Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы! Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества! Ура!
I will just launch into things right here. Hello, everyone. This is Siegfried for Back in the USSR. And I'm going to apologize again. For being just not on the ball the last few weeks and just not doing live shows. But as I said, I've got a lot on my plate. I'm putting out books now. I've got like a lot of things going on. So I've got radio is not always the first thing on my mind. But here we are. This is spring now. I'm just going to be optimistic. We're gonna do a follow-up to a show I did in January. I did this show with Jensen Williams of Guelph Wellington Women in Crisis. And we talked about the issue of violence against women in the course of the pandemic, kind of went back and talked about some other issues such as the École Polytechnique massacre back in 1989. We talked about the various actions which took place last year around the atrocity which took place at Western. Where like there was a mass case of sexual assault, sexual violence. And we talked about a lot of these other kind of issues, whether it was like violence against women in activist circles, which should be safe, but in many cases are not. There was certain things we missed that I would very much like to talk about today. That's why I brought them back here. But I'm just going to give a brief content warning. We're going to be discussing some heavy topics, but just like in our last interview, we want to emphasize the point that people can take meaningful action and make real change. We're going to be discussing that too. So this is Jensen Williams, public educator at Guelph Wellington Women in Crisis. And just thanks so much for coming back. It's great to have you back.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So I just thought, because one of the heavy subjects we talked about last time, and this tied in also with the vigil that happened last year, with all the names that were read out at that vigil, and you know, Guelph Wellington Women in Crisis did their best to not just emphasize these are not just names; these are people. They had hopes, dreams, lives to live, and we talked about how violence against women during the pandemic has increased. Right, this has been a very very difficult time. So I was just wondering if we could start out maybe with a bit of an update on where things stand with that right now, because I know some additional data has come out in terms of, you know, referrals, people being able to access services, and just where things are at right now. So going into the spring, I just maybe you could, you know, expand on that a little bit.
Yeah, for sure. You know, throughout the pandemic, we were getting a lot of questions about, you know, what the challenges are, what the changes have been for access to service. But because the pandemic is still ongoing, the reality is that we don't have a lot of concrete research to speak to kind of the impacts yet. But we're starting to see those now as the research has kind of been collecting and been starting to be released. And one, you know, some research that's just been released by the Ontario Coalition of Rape Crisis Centers, also known as the OCRCC, has surveyed the pandemic's impacts on survivors and support for those who are sexual violence survivors. And so typically what they had found, you know, in those surveys, and so the people that they're surveying are people who work at sexual assault centers across the province. And what they found from that survey is that survivors of violence in Ontario typically access more than one service, with 40% using between 5 to 7 services. And so it kind of speaks to the fact that, you know, what it means to be in crisis or to experience trauma has really been exacerbated through the pandemic, because not only are people experiencing violence, they're also experiencing job loss, income loss, many different layers of issues there. And so 70% of those centers who were surveyed agreed that there are new challenges when it comes to making referrals. So we're noticing that wait lists have been longer, that systems are harder to navigate. And one of the things that we've been seeing across centers, but it's also something we've really seen in Guelph Wellington, is the issue around affordable housing. So for those who are living with their abusive partner per se, it's really difficult to connect them with affordable housing programs, knowing that it's so difficult to access those, that again, the wait lists and times in which that can be achieved is super long because it's just not available. And so that's one of the things that we really need to think about, you know, is particularly going into this election year, some things that we can advocate for. 80% as well of survivor support services agreed that survivors' experiences with the criminal justice system have become more complex. So throughout the majority of COVID, the courts have been closed to the public for a lot of the time. And so what that's created is major delays. There's already significant delays when it comes to criminal justice processes, but it was individuals, you know, their cases essentially timing out because it's been too long since they've happened, or it's been too long since the charges were laid. And as well, you know, attending court online comes with a great deal of challenges, triggers. And yeah, due to those time limits, a lot of folks have been let down by that system. And as well, for, you know, speaking to kind of the law enforcement system and the prison industrial complex, for those who are being charged and held in custody, they're being released a lot quicker into the community because they didn't want to have people congregating in criminal justice and correction settings. And so those abusers that typically would have had a place to go are then being released back into the community really quickly. So there's been a lot of challenges that services have found in terms of the ways in which survivors navigate systems and supports. Has really, you know, been challenged throughout the pandemic. And I just want to commend, you know, sexual assault centers for all of the work that they've continued to do to address and fight these challenges.
Well, yeah, because that's so hard. I mean, you also have some of these centers are few and far between, and they don't have the greatest funding situation in the world. So they're under-resourced and they're trying to meet this demand, which is an incredible demand, right? That women are facing right now. And this is the real world impact, right, of all these different factors kind of coming down, and we're going to talk about, like, say, policies that might be able to address these things, but a lot of the stuff is just so overdue. Like, we can't just have like all this coming down on like these stretched thin services and just hope for them to kind of like meet this kind of just tidal wave that's incoming.
Right. For sure.
It's really, yeah. I mean, it's really kind of sobering when you see that, like the numbers, the sheer numbers, mm-hmm. the sheer demand. But I wanted to start out with that just because, you know, we talked about that last time and that's so important. But like originally we were going to do this interview around International Women's Day. And it got postponed. I mean, like, you know, we're all busy people here, but there isn't a bad time. There's never a bad time to talk about International Women's Day. It's always a relevant subject. So I was thinking maybe we could get into, like, right now we could get into International Women's Day. What, because we had an event, one of the first live events that Wellington Women in Crisis did in quite a long time, that was pretty well attended back in March in downtown Guelph. And there's the whole history of International Working Women's Day, as originally was called, and its significance for the labor movement. It was significance for women everywhere. And to this day, like, just how huge it is all around the world. You have like mass demonstrations in a lot of places. You have tens of thousands of women on the streets and allies and just everybody continuing to fight for these rights, which in many cases exist on paper, but have not been actualized mm-hmm. in a lot of places. So maybe we could get into some of the history of International Women's Day, like how it began and like just what its significance is, if you want to kind of kick things off on that.
Sure. Yeah, I will say, I was like, in full honesty, I've always been kind of a like pessimist about International Women's Day, just like as a woman. I'm just kind of like, oh, it's just the one day of the year. And especially kind of that chance for corporations to sort of jump on a bandwagon, say that they care about these things, one day of the year. And so it's never felt like something that I like super duper related to as being like a great and empowering day for me. But when I kind of, you know, started to delve into the history a little bit more, it sort of contextualized, you know, how this has been important for, you know, other women especially, and that kind of made it a bit more important to me as well. So Looking at that history, it was really started by like working class women who were advocating for their rights in textile factories in New York City, and, you know, holding strikes and walkouts and demonstrations, you know, specifically looking at female dominated industries such as, you know, textile factories or sewing factories or bakeries, where they weren't necessarily feeling as if their rights were being protected or that they weren't being valued in the way that they should have been. And, you know, then it's since grown to talk about, you know, voting rights for women and democratic rights and different areas of kind of what it means to have rights, specifically looking at the Western world. So now it's, I think, looking at as well the place that outside of the Western world where maybe women don't have, you know, as close to equal rights, you know, even though we don't have that achieved yet, you know, there's still areas in which women can't vote or can't drive or where marital rape is legal. And so we see, you know, these different areas, it's really using, you know, what are the rights that those women in this area care about and how are they joining together to advocate for those things? And so that's why it's really great to see now it's kind of we're adapting with the times to see, you know, what are the issues facing women today, where you live, what you care about, and how you can join together as women. And particularly now, you know, I think it's an opportunity, and this is something that we chatted about during the event, is that we need men and other folks to celebrate International Women's Day as well, because so often it's just women who are advocating for our own rights. And as sometimes feminists want to feel that we don't need men for anything, sometimes we definitely need those voices around the table to say, hey, these rights are important and we need to help be advocating for them as well and be good male allies. And so kind of, you know, looking at the history, it's really backed on the rights of working, you know, lower and middle class women, advocating for, you know, having the same rights as ones that maybe having more privilege might afford you. So it's interesting to see that history, and I think how that history has adapted and relatively stayed the same in some ways if it's looking at, you know, what is facing the modern woman today and no matter where they are, and how can they use this day to continue kind of that that political advocacy.
Yeah, because I mean that's huge. I've done an episode on International Women's Day, like on this show, you know, for the last like several years, right? Like it's been a very regular thing that I've done. I kind of held off on doing it this year because we had like this stuff scheduled. And well, there's a lot of other stuff going on in the world too that were kind of stressing me out. So I had to kind of talk about that. But yeah, like last year, I remember talking about on this show about just the mass mobilization that was going on in places like Chile, like India, where in India in particular, it was in the context of the farmers movement, the farmers strike that was going on all over, resisting the privatization of the agricultural system. And women played such a massive role in that. So International Women's Day was that they just were amping up the strike. There were tens of thousands assembling in New Delhi. And there were actually like female guards at these different events as well, like just for security, because they actually were facing some major security threats, you know, from the police, from like various far right groups that are actually affiliated with the government in India, because the government in India is very far right and very anti-women and very misogynist the way it stands right now. It's one of the least safe places in the world to be a woman. And so that's why this mobilization had such a massive meaning. And just seeing how assertive the women were who were speaking at this kind of event. And it was kind of similar in Chile, where like there's been major protests against austerity and neoliberalism going on for years now. And the amount of sexual violence visited on those demonstrators by the police has just been horrendous. And that is where like the, I think that's the first place where they did that whole, you know, those mass kind of choreographed kind of dances that were kind of like, you know, thousands of women together singing that one song. Was it "The Rapist Is You"? Right. And they kind of like did this kind of almost choreographed kind of spread around the world. Like it went to Europe. It went to other parts of the, you know, this anti-rape song, you know, anti-sexual violence song. And it basically just spread around the world. Like all these women were singing this, you know, and just standing up against the abuse they suffered, collectively voicing their defiance. And that started in Chile. That started with these kind of protests against austerity that took on a added dimension because of the amount of sexual violence against women and the amount of like mobilization that inspired. So that was one thing I really kind of just found, like I needed to kind of just tell people what was going on, because like the way it stands in Western countries, oftentimes we don't pay attention to this international situation. Yeah, we don't know what's going on in these other places, especially if it's in the global South. Mm-hmm. Right. And I find that is something I can use my platform for. Constructive thing I can do is drawing attention to these struggles that people aren't going to hear about if they just listen to the mainstream news. Mm-hmm. That's something which is very close to my heart. So I really believe in that. So that's something I try to do. The other thing I was going to bring up is, yeah, International Women's Day, originally called International Working Women's Day, founded in 1910 by Clara Zetkin, who was a communist woman. I believe she was one of the first women to be in the German parliament. And that was in 1910. And it was explicitly supposed to be a socialist kind of holiday. It was not like just supposed to, obviously it did fight for suffrage, but it also fought for economic rights as well. And later on, of course, it also was anti-colonial as well. And that was in the context of the Third International, the establishment of the USSR, the establishment of like the international is kind of this movement that was going to fight against colonialism as well as capitalism all around the world in the 1920s. So you had women who were participated in the Bolshevik Revolution, you know, like the February Revolution that overthrew the Tsar in 1917. What really galvanized, what really kind of took that to the level of a revolution, instead of it being just simply a protest, a bread riot, as it originally started out as, just the level of mobilization from women textile workers in the Vyborg district of St. Petersburg. That was actually what led to, you know, tens of thousands of people being on the streets, sustained protests, even when they're facing like getting shot at by the army. They still stayed on the streets. And in the end, like the army itself actually melted away because too many people refused to fire on civilians. And that was what ended up bringing the Tsar down. Just like, first, it's International Women's Day. All the women go out, the men, you know, they basically pull the men out with them. And then that ultimately just destroys the foundations of the entire regime. It's an amazing moment in history. It's something that needs to be emphasized. Whenever you talk about that period of time, International Women's Day just looms so large. And that transformed an entire society, right? A deeply patriarchal society. And that began to move in a completely new direction. I mean, after 1917, you actually started seeing a lot of the kinds of pro-women services and reforms and things like that benefit women, like legal abortion, childcare, healthcare, guaranteed housing, you know, access to employment, pay equity, all this stuff emerged out of that because of the role that women played. That's another thing that doesn't really get talked about. And I like to emphasize when I talk about the International Women's Day, like on the show, but it's celebrated in so many different ways around the world. I mean, it's celebrated in a lot of, it's a public holiday in countries like Cuba and China. It still is in Russia and a lot of the former socialist countries in Eastern Europe. You know, they didn't stop being a holiday after that, even though like the, you know, a lot of cases, the meaning of it kind of fell away because now, well, capitalism's in charge, and you know, and this is just the day you buy flowers for your girlfriend. It's that kind of day, right? And just like, okay, that's really not what it's about. But I understand your frustration about, you know, International Women's Day kind of being like such a kind of a corporatized thing in many parts of the world.
It's yeah, really it's not, definitely that's not lost the spirit. That kind of mobilization around like transformation, and now it's more like, I think it is, you know, it's an opportunity to say like, hey, let's celebrate all the amazing things that women have done. But I think what gets missed is like, okay, and then let's also continue to advocate for where we still need to go. Because I think, you know, in a lot of folks' mind, like, they feel as if we live in a pretty gender equal world, because they compare it to, oh, you know, well, 10 years ago or 15 or 20 years ago, this is how things were.
Right.
And of course we make progress, and yeah, it doesn't happen overnight, but there's still progress to be made. And, you know, even looking at, you know, the feminist movement and how, you know, that's talked about, you know, women and men should be equal. And I'm like, you know, of the mind that all gender identities should have, you know, equality and equity. So now including members of the trans and non-binary and two-spirit communities, like, I think that that's an area that we really need to reflect on, you know, when it comes to gender equality. And so, yes, let's celebrate, you know, yes, let's, you know, do things for the women in our life that make them feel celebrated, but let's also advocate for ways in which they can continue to succeed, and access spaces and access supports and services and income and affordable housing. So I think we need to, you know, really center that the political nature of International Women's Day as well, and not just focus too much you know, rah, rah, women, let's go. For sure, I think that's important, but I think it's also about, you know, we need to make that a bit more meaningful. And that's something that I've struggled with International Women's Day in the past is, you know, it's just kind of corporations and businesses being like, yeah, look at this, like, women's initiative that we have. And it's like, what is that actually doing?
It's like PR, basically. It's like, PR. They're just doing PR pitches, and it's just like, well, that's not what we need. That's not, you know, that is not empowerment.
We see the same thing happening every year with Pride, right?
You know? Exactly, right? Like, that was the comparison I was going to make. It was just like, yeah, because that's the frustration everybody keeps saying, right? Like, they go to Pride, and RBC is there, and like all these banks are there, and then then the cops are there, and like, you know, people of color aren't feeling safe, right? This kind of thing. It's just like, this is the kind of thing that kind of hollows out these days, you know, like, if we let them, I should say. But the Guelph event last month, I mean, how do you think it went? I mean, when was the last time that Guelph Wellington Women in Crisis did an event like that?
It would have been right before COVID. So it was, March 8th, 2020. And then we were in lockdown like 5 days later. So like pre-COVID. Wow. But we haven't had an International Women's Day. This was our first one in person since then. So 2 years. And it was really nice. Like, it was nice. I think people were really ready to be in community and, you know, to celebrate. But I was also really appreciative, you know, we had a march, and that was kind of our attempt to say, you know, let's make this political, let's come out and advocate for the change that we still want to see. And one of my favorite parts of the event was that we had, you know, a grade six class join us, and they had their signs, and it was really great to see, like, you know, people from many different generations come out and join that event. And pretty decent turnout. I think there were some really good conversations that were had, some good media coverage, and, you know, an opportunity to talk more about, you know, the mission of International Women's Day, what it's about. And to have, I think, another pro for me was to see lots of folks there that, like, I'd never met before, people who hadn't really come to our events. So it was nice to have, you know, be right downtown, have that visibility, that celebration. And I think people were really just ready to feel part of the community again. So I was really happy with how it went. That was good.
Yeah, it was really good. I mean, well, you got me to do Zumba dancing for the first time. That was pretty epic. I like the picture on that went up on like Guelph Wellington Women in Crisis on the Facebook page afterwards. Kind of has me like almost doing the splits. Like, it's just I look really weird, but it was fun. I was into it.
And it proved to me how uncoordinated I was, but that's fine.
Yeah, I was just kind of like It's something I threw myself into.
Yeah, sometimes you gotta do that.
Yeah. Hey, first time. There's a first time for everything. So there we go. So that's, I think, really good conversation about International Women's Day. You know, that's the kind of it's a good overview, and there's a lot more that could be said, but we did want to get into like other stuff. And I know your time is limited here today. So one of the things we did not get to when we talked last time in January is just the role that media kind of plays in gender stereotypes, also in how relationships are portrayed in the media. Like, this is something I remember Guelph Monsoon Women in Crisis did kind of talk a bit about in the winter. I can't remember when exactly, but I remember you, there were some posts about like certain how movies sometimes portray like relationships, interactions in these kind of situations. And some of them is kind of, is pretty problematic. And the idea that it normalizes, because I mean, this is media that's consumed by, well, millions of people, and how it kind of normalizes certain behaviors that are not healthy. And that's something I wanted to get into here today. So I'm just thinking like, maybe you could kind of kick us off with a discussion about that, because that's something that's, I'm sure, comes up quite a lot.
Yeah. Well, we learned so much about human behavior and relationships through media. You know, it's a lot of the ways in which we learn about relationships and, you know, what we deem as normal and healthy. And, you know, there's common, you know, stories or types of stories that kind of portray what we would deem as maybe unhealthy behaviors disguised as love. And so one, you know, example is this idea that if someone continues to try to get you as you know, as their person, so continuing to try to ask you out or continuing to try to make those advances, and you continue to say no, that, you know, oh, it's this person, they're just a hopeless romantic, and, you know, it's flattering, they really want to be with you. So this is kind of this idea that we see a lot of different ways portrayed, is this idea that if you try really, really hard and you continue to try, you don't take no for an answer, then you'll probably get the girl or you get what you want.
Yeah,
and so we see that happen, you know, and there's several different, you know, kind of stories in which that sort of comes up. But there's also, you know, TV shows that will normalize, you know, unhealthy behaviors. We see a lot where there's maybe movies or TV shows where we see partners going through, say, each other's phones, or, you know, we see stalking behaviors taking place. So behaviors where, again, it's like that, well, you're showing your love through someone, for someone, through, you know, stalking or trying to get control over them. You know, if you just want to spend time with this person and no one else, and you're isolating them from their friends and their family and so forth. And so I would say that that's normalized in a lot of different senses. This kind of, it's disguised as love, but it's maybe that unhealthy love. Or, you know, it's trying to change someone so they can be your perfect person. And, you know, this idea that people have to change, you know, sometimes change is good, change can be for the better. But I think we see that other ways, you know, these kind of like makeover stories and that type of thing. And, you know, another thing, you know, it's not maybe considered, you know, to be our common mainstream media, but it's one of the most common things that we consume is pornography. Pornography, a lot of people, you know, it's totally normal and shameless to access that. Most people do. But it's looking at how that internalizes certain behaviors and how certain things become normalized, because I think a lot of folks are seeing it as an educational tool that leads to expectations rather than seeing it as, you know, fantasy and entertainment. It's seeing it as something where, you know, we're not talking about consent and, you know, the type of sex that's been had. It's kind of, you know, expectations that people are seeing in porn, they're expecting of their partners. And when their partners aren't acting like the people in porn, it's like, well, I saw this, why won't you do this?
Yeah, why won't you do it?
And, exactly. And so, you know, it's, I think that has a really deep impact, particularly on our like young people who are consuming this as a way to learn about sex. And then having that be the expectation that, you know, all girls like it rough, or it's okay to do things without asking. That's what they like, you know? And, you know, we see it also being like really focused on like male pleasure a lot of the time. And so it's really interesting just to, you know, talk about how violence is also normalized through pornography. And, you know, there are different types of violent pornography that, that people enjoy, you know, but I think that's, it's, and it's okay to enjoy that and to see that, but recognize that, you know, this is entertainment, this is fantasy, this isn't something that we can expect, but a lot of people, you know, and it goes both ways. It's the expectation on women too, that if you don't act this way, like the girls do in porn, then, you know, you're not very good in bed. And so it creates, you know, this idea of violence in a lot of different ways and how that's internalized. So both, you know, larger media, kind of this disguising unhealthy or abusive behaviors as love, but also I think pornography would be, you know, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention, you know, how I think that contributes to violence, particularly around sexual violence.
Oh yeah. I mean, I was going to bring that up. So you just kind of like beat me to it there, but yeah, like 100%. Right. And of course there are like some very problematic like elements in porn. Like, I mean, where you have like, say the teacher having sex with the student, or like the, that's a common one, or like, and now increasingly you have the landlord having sex with the tenant. right? And kind of using kind of manipulative tactics to kind of get them to do that. I mean, with the student, it was kind of like, you know, about grades, and with the tenants about like, you know, your rent, and like you're behind on rent. So you got to sleep with me if you want to, you know, still have a roof on your head. And that's a really common kind of trope out there now. And just seeing this kind of stuff, it's just like, this is horrible. Right. And like, just how abusive that is. And that's like, not even going into like all this other stuff, like where you don't see consent being given and all this stuff, you know, let alone enthusiastic consent, right? Like being given, it's like, you know, people being talked into things and like doing this stuff. And like, you know, the whole, you know, being portrayed as submissive in certain ways. And just like, yeah, it's not a healthy scenario that we're seeing there that is promoting healthy relationships between people. And that's something, well, I mean, that itself is something that's really important to talk about, right? Because if we're talking about the things, which I remember you bringing this up during, what was it? It was Take Back the Night last year. And just these different themes like empowerment, honesty, consent, boundaries, communication, combating gender stereotypes, healthy masculinity, these kind of things, these aren't showing up on screen.
I would say, you know, there are some, I've recently seen some examples where I'm like, okay, they've definitely gotten it right. Mm-hmm. So like one example that it's called Generation. It was a show that I recently have watched, and it, you know, it talked a lot about like gender and sexuality in a really nuanced way. Mm-hmm. Same with the show Sex Education. It's on Netflix. It's a really great one. Euphoria, I would say, is the show. It's a little bit hard to watch. Like, it can be dark in some senses. It touches upon, you know, addictions, mental health, sexual assaults, unhealthy and abusive relationships for young people. But I think it does so in a really nuanced way. And so I'm seeing some examples in media where they're making an effort to try to tackle these things. Mm-hmm. And I just think it needs to be more widely accessible. Because every time I watch something like that, I'm like, oh, I wish that I had this when I was younger. To have this kind of example in the representation. And I'm grateful that like people are getting that now, but I think we just need to have more of that. It needs to be more mainstream, because it's still, you know, it's not the dominant. It kind of is seen as a bit like of an outlier. And it's just like shows being super honest about it and coming at it as if it at a very clear cut way, rather than, you know, trying to cover it up or not discussing it at all.
Yeah. Like being actual honest about it, right? Like actually taking this kind of stuff on head on. Right. And there's a way to do that. Right. So yeah, because one of the things that has kind of come up, I think we briefly mentioned it last time we talked, but it was like kind of moving away from just talking about what to avoid and getting into, okay, like what is healthy, right? What is good? What should we be doing? Positive examples, this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And because it's easy to be overwhelmed like with the negative and be afraid, right?
Yeah.
If all we're talking about is like just these negative things and things to watch out for, things to avoid, all this stuff. And you got to take all these precautions, you know, in your relationships, like if that's all there is, that's going to make people want to just, you know, clam up. Mm-hmm. And that's like really hard to deal with. So it's really important to talk about these things. But like one of the things, which as somebody who is a writer, you know, it's one of the things that's really kind of, I've had to work on is how I represent female characters in my writing. And this is something that comes up. It's, you know, this is increasingly in the conversation around all types of media, but including in different genres of fiction, right? Like in the fantasy genre, that's where I write. Just, you know, how are women portrayed? What role do they play in these alternate worlds we create? I mean, it might not be the real world we're even talking about, but there is a history, there's a culture. We got to get into gender when we get into these kind of alternate realities, alternate worlds, and conversations need to be had about that and like what that looks like. So that's been a challenge for me, like when I do this, and also like not to make it a exercise in box ticking,
right?
Which turns into tokenism, right? Like where the person is just there just because they're queer. They don't actually have any, they're not actually a three-dimensional being, you know, they're just there because, oh, okay, we've got to have a queer person here. And like, okay, what's the role in the plot? Like, are they developed? Like, do you get into their backstory? Do they have a really proper character arc that we can follow and we can engage with and this sort of thing? And this, I guess you could say this for female characters as well. You could talk about this with racialized people as well. And you don't always see a very good job being done with this kind of thing, especially I find in movies. I mean, this is the infamous like Dumbledore is gay thing, in Harry Potter, right? Like, it doesn't have anything to do with anything.
Yeah.
And they're not going to get into, say, like, I mean, this is a coming of age story. Like, wouldn't it be great if, say, Hermione, like, finds out, okay, they're actually attracted to other women, you know, and maybe they can be attracted to guys as well, but like they are basically queer. How do they navigate that? That could have been an amazing story,
mm-hmm.
right? An amazing character arc, but that did not happen. But like, yeah, presenting, like, how do I present like female characters? Yeah, if you have things to kind of add to this, like how you've seen like female characters kind of be developed in the media. I don't know, like if you are really into the same kind of genre I am, but like if you have opinions on this, if you've like really seen how this stuff has evolved over time. And
yeah, I mean, I'm not coming at this from like a writer's perspective, more like a media consumer's perspective of mm-hmm. like what I enjoy from characters who bring some sort of diversity to the table, whether it's around their gender, their sexuality, their race, is just having nuance in their stories mm-hmm. and not it being, you know, falling into these tropes that we always hear or these archetypes. And I think just like being complex and even being flawed, and particularly for characters right. like maybe who are queer, is to not have their story be focused on like their struggles as a queer person, to just focus on like this is one part of their identity, and you know, they have maybe celebrations or like good things that are happening to their lives. I find so often those stories are like rooted in traumas, and so I think that it's good to have, you know, some nuance and diversity in terms of what the characters look like, because we do have, you know, these archetypes that are kind of characterized that, you know, people think that they're relatable, but they're not, because we hold so many different identities and we are flawed and messy. But at the same time, we also, you know, hold a multitude of identities and experiences. And mm-hmm. I think just having like backstory and like reasons for why they are the way that they are, and you know, you're giving some context to the characters and how they navigate it, and you know, not just be, you know, if you're having female characters writing about like their experiences with sexism, you know, you're making it a bit more nuanced than that. So I would say just like nuance is key in terms of what I enjoy from those characters, is just having them have really like unique backstories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I love to hear that, because I agree with that 100%. And that's what I found that was kind of, that was problematic about some of the characters that recently have kind of appeared in movies. And that includes like the recent Star Wars movies. I mean, a lot of the criticism of Rey in the recent Star Wars trilogy from Disney, which has gotten a lot of like, you know, pushback, some of it constructive, some of it not. But one of the criticisms was, it's just like the female character is just so flawless. Just so they never make mistakes. They have no weaknesses whatsoever. They succeed at everything they try. They're not allowed to fail. And it's like, well, is that actually a empowering message? I mean, feminism was never supposed to be about being flawless. And I mean, this goes back to like, I mean, hell, Virginia Woolf wrote about this stuff back in the early 20th century, like talking about the Victorian woman as like this paragon of virtue, and how, what a gilded cage that was. In terms of like, you know, if you make one mistake, you become a fallen woman, you mm-hmm. know, and you're basically, you know, cast aside and stuff like that. And just these kind of like stereotypes, like, I mean, you should not have to be flawless to deserve respect. And mm-hmm. that's kind of like one of the central messages that I understand the feminism was always tried to get. And so having a flawless female character in your book that is not allowed to fail, like they're not allowed to have any weaknesses whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Like that is, I don't think that's constructive.
Yeah, and there's another thing that like I know I learned about like in university, and I think it's called the Bechdel test. Like if you've heard of that before, it's like you're looking at, you know, for female characters, like how often are their conversations and their dialogue like centered around men? Is, you know, another thing is that just like so often like the female character's identity is tied to men in some ways. And so I think it's like making sure that they are like unique characters, that they have their own lives and realities. That's another thing, and something that maybe look into in terms of like when you're going through your writing or even analyzing media, to kind of something to be mindful of, to see how often that's happening.
Yeah, like that's absolutely. I mean, I'm gonna have to check that out then. I'm surprised I actually haven't heard about it. But yeah, I mean, one of the things I mentioned was how in my books, like the Foulhorn novels, you know, now I've got like two of them, they're both out. Yeah, Foulhorn, The World is Burning, and Foulhorn, Dark Dawn. And both of those are out. And both of them are set in a very patriarchal feudal society. But the role that women play in this kind of, in the society where you have like this persecuted group, they're a religious group, you know, persecuted religious group who follow the old gods. You know, they are basically polytheists in a, you know, in a place that's dominated by a monotheistic church, you know, and monotheistic state and this sort of thing. And they face persecution for generations. And the role that women play in keeping that resistance culture going and keeping the community going, keeping it together, and how these old believers, they have strong matriarchal traditions. And even though they've been undermined in recent years, they're still very prominent. Mm-hmm. And the role that women play, they actually have a head woman basically who runs the Agoge Council, which is like what runs their community. So even though like the actual main character is male in this novel, there are the role that women play. I mean, he could not succeed at pretty much at a lot of things if he didn't have that kind of, if it weren't for what the women are doing. Right. And you do actually see things through their gaze. And in fact, like, and how the stuff that they do to protect their community and the powers that they wield, some of them actually do have, you know, magic does come into play and things like that. And I plan to expand on that in the sequel, which I haven't written. I've only got an outline for it thus far, but there's basically three main characters who you're going to see a lot from their perspective. That's Jenny, Taya, and Sevi. And all of them are basically in this. They're the three women who are part of this elite military formation. They're the only women in it. And right away, how they got into it is a story in and of itself. Mm-hmm. One got into it because they were the prince's mistress. One got into it because they were like a, you know, one of the few female knights in this part of the world who, you know, basically challenged the man who killed her father and beyond all expectations won in that duel. And then that got the attention of the prince, got inducted. And the other was just like a servant girl who just got like, you know, oh, wouldn't it be fun? Wouldn't it be funny just to see them kind of inducted into this military formation, see how they would do. So all these women have to have backstories. They have places where they're coming from. They're trying to survive in a very male dominated environment and how they respond to that. And they have very, very different personalities. They have very different personalities, right? I mean, some of them are definitely very bitter about what they've been through. I mean, Jenny in particular, who's based on Pirate Jenny from the Three Penny Opera, which is our mutual friend, Kayla Wyler's favorite thing that, like one of her favorite musicals. Basically a very vengeful sex worker is basically their backstory. That was actually what they did before they were a soldier.
Love it.
So it's like, there's a lot of stuff like this. I don't know how long it's going to take me to write this, mm-hmm. but there's a lot, just how I'm going to develop these characters. I'm probably going to need a lot of input on this stuff. Cause I just, yeah. One last thing about this before we move on, but like, I just feel we need to really move beyond stuff like Lord of the Rings, Game of Thrones, all this stuff. There are so many women fantasy authors who are doing great things, especially indie women fantasy authors mm-hmm. who publish their own stuff and aren't beholden to corporations like to get their stuff out there. Brilliant works, but you don't see their stuff getting, you instead you see like yet another adaptation of Game of Thrones or another adaptation of, you know, Lord of the Rings. You know, like we're just constantly giving these authors more time. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, give some space here. Like give some space for new people, like new blood, new ideas, especially from women. Mm-hmm. Like it's about time.
Yeah, for sure.
So yeah, I know we only got about 10 minutes left. So I was going to give you an opportunity to kind of, before we get into like the election coming up, is there any workshops you want to plug first of all, because you know, you've been running quite a few of those recently. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, one thing that I've been really focused on right now is a series that I've been working on with the Sexual Assault Support Center of Waterloo Region and their Male Allies program. Mm-hmm. Is a 4-part series focused at breweries, bars, those in the hospitality and entertainment industry, focused on addressing, preventing sexual violence. And so we've had 4 sessions. We have had 2 so far. The first one was on the impacts of trauma and self-care for survivors. The one last night we had on bystander intervention. We have 2 left. Mm-hmm. So next Thursday, April 28th at 6 p.m., we have a male allies panel discussion. So this is a particular focus to those who are in that industry, but it's also relevant to those who aren't. So while there will be some info that's specifically for that audience, there's also going to be lots of info that folks can take away with. And then our last training is for around how to create workplace equity. So specifically for those who might be in organizational leadership positions, regardless of the industry you're in. I think that would be really helpful. That one's on May 4th from 9:30 to 11:30 a.m. All of these are free, and if you're interested in registering, you can find all the info on our website at gwwomenincrisis.org or on our social media on all platforms. It's at GWWIC. So that's one thing that we really, you know, I'd like to highlight for folks that's happening currently as well. May, which is coming up soon, is Sexual Violence Prevention Month. And so we're going to likely have some programming around that as well. So it's also an opportunity if you're part of any community organization, specifically in Guelph, Wellington, and you want to use that month for an opportunity to have some training for your staff or your volunteers and or community group that you're part of, you can always reach out to us as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. I mean, that all sounds really good. I mean, I've attended like a number of workshops thus far, like starting last year, and they're always great. They're always amazing. You know, always very, very helpful and just very illuminating. And I'm very grateful we have that, you know, and people can reach out and be a part of that. Yeah, so I would encourage people to do that.
Mm-hmm. And if you're listening and you're not in Guelph, Wellington, any like lots of different communities, if not most of them, have some sort of gender-based violence center, and almost all of them do have some form of public education program. So if you're not local, figure out what that service might be in your community and how you can support them and attend some of their events too.
Yeah, exactly. But once again, I just want, you do a great job, Jensen. I love it. I love the way you do that stuff. That's amazing. What I want to wrap things up on here is just the upcoming provincial election. We talked a little bit about like policy and what that's, what we also talked about a bit in the winter as well. You know, what kind of policy change we need to actually benefit women and kind of, especially in the times we live in, you know, with the pandemic and this sort of thing where women are increasingly facing these kind of violent situations. Like what kinds of policy is going to really address that? And like what, as far as you know, like what are the different parties saying at this point?
Yeah, I'll be honest with you and say that I have not super looked into each of the platforms yet.
I have not either, but
I'll get there when I get there. But in terms of, you know, I think when we talk about, you know, gendered issues, what we tend to think of is policies that specifically address those issues as being the ones that will create change. And while they certainly can, I would say that all policies have gendered impacts to some degree. And that's why, you know, we're talking about what I'm particularly passionate about is addressing not just gender-based violence on face value, but also the root causes of it and what continues to keep cycles of violence going. And so what I was saying earlier, when we were talking about barriers and things that survivors have been facing throughout the pandemic, lack of affordable housing has been a huge one. You know, we think about why aren't people leaving those abusive relationships? A lot of the times it's, you know, for some economic reasons. The fact that you know, women are still in lower paying jobs, you know, the majority of low wage or precarious workers are women identified. And so it's important to look at, you know, how can we advocate for things like higher minimum wage? I think that's something that would have great gendered benefits. You know, a lot of women do a lot of unpaid labor as well, if we're looking at parenting and overall kind of our expectation of being nurturers or caregivers in our society that we live in. So I would say advocating for, you know, higher minimum wage, affordable housing, you know, more community programming. So things that keep people connected to their community, whether that's healthcare, mental health, you know, youth programming is huge. I would say that's such a great piece in violence prevention is youth programming, you know, programs that can help give youth that sense of community and empowerment, can help teach them different life skills. And as well, of course, you know, greater funding for organizations like Guelph Wellington Women in Crisis, your gender-based violence centers locally. You know, we've heard a lot about possible changes to having some form of universal childcare or, you know, low cost options. And I think that would be huge as well. You know, some people are paying as much for childcare as they are for rent. And so we need to think about, you know, not only the issues that are facing women, but also, you know, the costs that women have. We pay double what men pay for, you know, certain products, for example. And so there nearly needs to be gender equity in a lot of different ways when we look at policies. So it's looking at, when you're thinking about policies and you're hearing the platform, try to see them through a gendered lens and to think about the different impacts that they might have on different identities or marginalized communities, because, you know, not all policies are created equal. They're created with certain individuals in mind.
Exactly.
So we need to make sure that, you know, marginalized populations and individuals are you know, in mind when we're making those policies. And it's really important that I think we stay politically engaged to the best of our ability and, you know, honestly, just get out and vote. I think that's a huge thing. Exercise your democratic rights, because a lot of the times we do see lower voter turnouts and we're seeing higher voter turnouts, particularly for younger people. And so I would say, you know, continue to do that no matter who you are voting for, get out and vote. Is a great way, I think, to exercise and you know, do so in an informed way where you understand, you know, what you believe and what you want and which party might align with that.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And I mean, 1,000,000%. Right. I mean, all this stuff is super important. And I mean, I'm not actually running in the election this time. So, I mean, maybe we could actually have you back on at some point and we could actually talk about this in relation to the election once we know more stuff. But the actual platforms. But I really want to thank you for being on the show today, right? This has been amazing. And I'm always like very appreciative of you taking the time. So thank you very much, Jensen.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, no worries. Anytime.
Woche das Bett für jeden. Und sie geben mir eine Penny und ich bedanke mich schnell. Und sie sehen meine Lumpen und das lumpige Hotel. Und sie wissen nicht, mit wem sie reden. Und sie wissen nicht, mit wem sie reden. Aber eines Tages wird ein Geschrei sein am Hafen und man fragt, was ist das für ein Geschrei? Und man wird mich lächeln sehen bei meinen Gläsern. Und man fragt, was lächeln die dabei? Und ein Schiff.
Bip, 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 bip Right on. Hey. Come on.